Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we talk to Sophie Saylor, a local singer who appeared on Star Search. Experience Grand Rapids has launched its AI accessibility travel tool. We talk about that. We talk about the books Outsmarting Cancer and The Devil's Bible. And Master Arts Theater presents The Women of Lockerbie, a poetic drama. And we talk to the director.
She appeared on Star Search. Sophie Saylor on the line. She's going to talk about her experience, journey back home after competing on this Star Search on behalf of Netflix. Proud to represent women and people with disabilities on the hit show. Be careful what you wish for. Good morning to you. To you, Sophie Saylor.
Hi. Hello.
S-A-Y-L-O-R when you're doing your search for you. All right, take me back to when you first started your talent of singing.
Oh my gosh, man, it's pretty, honestly, it's a pretty crazy story. Because obviously I was that kid like walking around singing, annoying my entire family constantly with how much The Little Mermaid I would just randomly belt out at 3 a.m. But I mean, I really started actually professionally doing it when I was about 8 or 9, right? Found Andy O'Reilly, of course, my Pookie. I was watching the Cubs game. It was the year that the Cubs made the World Series. And we were watching it, and this guy, he was singing the national anthem, and cocky 8-year-old me was like, oh, man, this guy, he is not good, okay? This guy was just not it for me, apparently. I don't know. I rewatched it, and he's really not that bad, but I guess I saw a problem with it. Either way, I was like, I can do it better. And my mom was like, well, if you're going to get a big head about it, then you're going to actually do it. Cause you're not going to talk a big game and then not do it. So my mom, she printed out the words of the national anthem and I held it all big to my face and whatever. And I sang it, and the people from the Lumberjacks got a hold of me through Facebook. And they're like, if you get this many likes, we'll let you sing in a game. And well, I did that. So I sang at the LC, or Trinity Health, I think it's called now. I can't remember, honestly. But I sang there for a few years, probably up until I was about 12-ish. And then, you know, COVID happened. And then after COVID, I didn't really pick it back up again. But I sang at basketball games in high school, for Shores and everything. And I did a bunch of, you know, solos in high school, and obviously that I had a solo in the same Christmas tree sophomore year, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I started posting on TikTok because I was like, you know, I see all these people and they sing on TikTok and it'd be kind of fun. And I was going through a breakup and I was like, well, wouldn't it be so funny if a guy dumped me and then I went viral? Like, that'd be so funny. Like, ah, ha, ha, ha. Like, and then it accidentally actually happened, and I was like, oh, oopsies. And so I went viral, and then they got a hold of me and were like, come on Star Search, it'd be so fun. And now we're here.
Thank you for all of that, and you're only 18. There we are. For one who's not familiar with Star Search, is this Netflix's Star Search? What makes this different than the others?
So Netflix decided to reboot Star Search because I think it was on in like the early 90s or something. Like Britney Spears was on it, Justin Timberlake, Beyonce. But it's super cool because a lot of shows like talent shows or Dancing with the Stars or like anything of the sort of talent shows, most of the time you have to like text the number to vote or do this or that. Whereas on Netflix's Star Search, you literally vote with your remote like live. So it's really cool because Netflix didn't used to do live events, but now they're like super live eventy. So it was fun, unique to do. And like, you literally just like stars popped up on the screen and you just like scrolled over with your remote and could click and it would immediately submit it, which is kind of cool. Cause then you can't rig the system. So the voting was live. You can't get 7 computers and like, you know what I mean? So it was super cool to have real life scores, and you found out if you were going home pretty much right after you were done, which was a lot better for my mental health because I'm like, oh my gosh, like now I gotta stay here and wait the whole episode. No, you literally find out right after, and it was scary.
Cool. All right, so what did you sing on Star Search?
So I made it through 3 rounds. I unfortunately went home the third one, but I started off with What Was I Made For by Billie Eilish. And as I said on the show, that song literally means the world, right? Because it represents women and everything that's going on right now. Women really need to be represented. And to sing a song like that is powerful, right? And it meant a lot. So that was definitely a good move. And then the second time we did Lay Me Down by Sam Smith. And that song is about grief. So I really wanted to focus on different emotions. And so for Lay Me Down, I wanted to focus on grief and missing someone that's no longer there. And, you know, or, you know, maybe they died or they left or whatever. And a lot of people can really relate to that feeling. And then the third song I did, We Can't Be Friends, which I like the song a lot because it can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. It can be about a relationship with your partner falling out. It can be like talking to the media, like, I'm never going to please you. We can't be friends no matter what I'm going to do. You're going to be upset kind of things. So, like, you can interpret that song in multiple different ways, which is really what I wanted to, I guess I didn't intend to end with that song, but it ended up that way. So, I mean,
that's the way life makes it happen, the way it ends up, how you cross the finish line. And again, representing women, people with disabilities on the hit show, and congratulations. You've done more than most, making it to a third round. What's your take-home message? I trust if we have a talent, if we have a goal, just do it, no matter what age?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much, like, don't sit there and wait around, you know, because it's not, that opportunity is not always going to be there. And you shouldn't let anything or anyone hold you back. You should follow your dreams, especially while you're young. You know, don't give it up for a relationship or anything else. Like, literally take your dreams and go chase them. And if it doesn't work out, at least you know that you tried and you did everything that you could. And if it works out, then you did it. You know what I mean? And it's always good to at least try. Because then you don't sit there when you're 80 years old going, man, I wish I would have done that, right? And now you can say, hey, I did it. It didn't work out, but I did it. I tried, right? It's so much better to feel that way.
Thank you for you. All right, what's next for Sophie Saylor?
I'm thinking about releasing music soon. I've got some things in the works. Dun, 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 right? So I'm pretty excited to really start my music journey. Maybe I'll do some gigs around town, and I guess it all depends on life.
You bet. Thanks to you. Thanks to Andy O'Reilly and, of course, the hookup and more. Where do I find out more information about you and maybe even watch your Star Search thing?
All of the Star Search performances are on Netflix. They will be on Netflix forever. I'm pretty sure there's some clips on YouTube. If you want to watch my actual singing videos, it's Sophie_sing731 on TikTok. And I do have a website, I believe it's like SophieSaylorOfficial.com or whatever, that has just more about me. So you can go ahead and go to that. I have an Instagram as well. It's Sophie Ann Marie, or you could just look at my name and I should pop up. But yeah, follow me there.
That's what you do. Thanks. Continued success to you, making West Michigan proud. Sophie Saylor, seen on Star Search, doing great things. Take care, Sophie.
Thank you.
By now, you're hearing the news. This is pretty cool, all to be up on the future. Experience Grand Rapids partnering with global accessible travel platform Wheel the World to launch a first-of-its-kind AI accessibility travel tool. Let's talk to you, Jalen McCloy, Marketing Partnership Manager at Experience Grand Rapids, to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Lots of partnerships in our backyard and, of course, the good work Experience Grand Rapids does, and now you do, to design helping travelers with disabilities find accessibility. Take it from here.
Yeah, absolutely. We're super excited to launch this new AI-powered accessibility travel agent. It's meant to bring together, you know, years of detailed accessibility data that we've done work with disability advocates of Kent County, and we partnered with Wheel the World to help kind of bring it to life. So we're super excited to have crafted this easy tool to help travelers plan trips to Grand Rapids to help find their accessibility, answer their accessibility questions, and also answer any questions they have about the destination in general.
Yes. Looking in the fine print, it looks like for many travelers with disabilities, the greatest barrier isn't always physical infrastructure. It's, Jalen, what, uncertainty?
Yes, it's absolutely uncertainty. Many times, you know, when people are traveling, they don't know what they don't know. So our goal here is to help bridge that gap and help answer those questions that they just need to know prior to coming. They need to know, you know, whether they have what the bed height is in a hotel room, or, you know, what the door looks like when they're coming into a restaurant, when they're getting ready to dine with us. We're helping take away some of that uncertainty so they can plan their trip with confidence to Grand Rapids.
You mentioned this, Jalen, but we are the first destination globally to implement this technology. And you've been working behind the scenes in accessible tourism. Is this a term that we should be hearing more of?
Yes, yeah, we are the first destination. We definitely are looking to see this become, kind of catch fire across, you know, other destinations to utilizing this tool to help travelers plan their trips.
All right, let's tell a story. I need to come to Grand Rapids, and perhaps I'm a wheelchair user. Where do I start?
Absolutely. So you can go to experiencegr.com/accessibility. And from there, in the lower left-hand corner, there will be a little chat bot. Will is the name of our AI companion there. And then you can start by asking questions. Say, hey, I would like to plan a trip to Grand Rapids. I'm a wheelchair user. What's the first thing that I need to know? And then it'll start to spit out some information. And you could also ask, you know, what hotels would you recommend me staying at, being a wheelchair user? And then it'll give you a list of recommendations. It'll highlight some of their accessibility information, you know, starting from the main entrance, what type of training staff has had, what those bed heights are going to be. And then you can continue planning your trip from there. It's like, I'm interested in arts and culture. Can you tell me what attractions are available in Grand Rapids and Kent County that I should look into visiting? And then it'll populate some different attractions like Frederick Meyer Gardens or the Grand Rapids Art Museum or the Public Museum. And it'll help build your trip essentially from there.
As of this last week of February, are we active now?
We are active, yes.
What if an organization wants to make sure that they're on the list?
Yeah, absolutely. They can reach out to me, Jalen McCloy, and we can help make sure that their accessibility information is available on our website, because that'll help feed into our chatbot. You know, we're inviting not only, you know, travelers to utilize the chatbot, but our local businesses as well. This is a new tool, so we want as much feedback as we can to make sure that we're spitting out the right answers to make sure that people have the correct information when they're looking to plan their trip.
It's a new tool, but I'm sure, like AI, it's a tool designed to grow, and you're ready to make that happen?
We absolutely are. We've had some early beta testers from our own local community, our team as well, along with the team at Wheel the World. So it's new, it's meant to grow, where we want to feed information into it, because the more we put into it, the better results it's going to spit out for us.
And I think we all know the answer to this question, but is Grand Rapids setting an example for other destinations to follow?
Yes, we absolutely are. We're leading the way in accessibility, along with other several destinations, but us being the first to kind of put this tool together, we're excited to see it roll out into other destinations and kind of help feed what accessible travel looks like, you know, not just in Grand Rapids and Kent County, but across the world.
Established in 1927, there might be an anniversary coming up, I would think, next year. Experience Grand Rapids leading the marketing of Grand Rapids, Kent County. Could you imagine 1927 having this discussion?
No, we've definitely come a long way, and we still have so much more to go. You know, accessibility is a journey. We're not stopping here. We're full steam ahead.
Great. In summary, what do you now offer for all?
Yes, absolutely. So we offer the confidence in trip planning to experience Grand Rapids. We offer the availability of an AI-powered chatbot or planning tool, essentially, to help travelers plan their trips to Grand Rapids. We have over 300-plus venue reviews through Disability Advocates of Kent County, mapping, you know, local businesses, hotels, restaurants, our local attractions. And then we have over 50 venue reviews with Wheel the World as well.
Partnerships. One more time, that best website to get started, please.
Yes, you can visit experiencegr.com/accessibility.
You can say that backwards. Jalen McCloy, Marketing Partnership Manager at Experience Grand Rapids. Thank you for including all with this AI accessibility travel tool that's been launched. Take care. Can we outsmart cancer? According to my next guest, yes. He writes about it, the book entitled Outsmarting Cancer, Risk Reduction and the Power of Prevention. I love that word, prevention. That's where we'll spend our time. Dr. Adam Barsuk with us. Dr. Barsuk, good morning to you.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, oncology fellow at Johns Hopkins University, of course, resident physician at the University of Pennsylvania, author to boot. Can we outsmart cancer, Dr. Adam?
I think we can be doing much better than we are now. I think we know that about 50% of all cancer deaths around the world are preventable, and it goes far beyond just smoking. Obesity, ultra-processed foods in our diet, exercise, all sorts of environmental pollutants in the air and the water, all of those increase our cancer risk. And I think if we were to make the right choices as individuals on a societal level, we could see half of all the cancer cases and cancer deaths that we do today.
In general, before I dig into the weeds, are we talking when we entitled Outsmarting Cancer, are we bundling up all of our cancers, or will we be specific on a couple of our conversations?
We're talking about all cancers. Obviously, the most common, breast, colorectal, lung. We're seeing all of these are on the rise in young adults, people under 50. The rate has over doubled. So that's where there's the most work to be done, and that's where we're seeing the most data about all these lifestyle factors leading to the rise in cancers. But truly, all cancers are on the rise in young adults, and all cancers have many risk factors that we can change in our daily lives to try and reduce that risk.
Yes, want to certainly get into that prevention as mentioned. But what is behind the young adult cancer epidemic? Do we have this yet?
That's the million-dollar question, right? We know a big contributor to it is obesity. Obesity is on the rise. Nearly 70% of all Americans are overweight or obese. And we know that obesity is linked to a number of cancers, not just colon, because the excess fat in our body produces inflammatory signaling molecules, cytokines, that send our immune system into overdrive and lead to cancers all over the body, breast, lung, and non-smokers, you name it. It's associated with obesity. But that's not the only piece to the puzzle, because I've seen plenty of patients in their 20s, 30s in my clinic who are in the healthiest, you know, shape of their lives, who are still coming in with cancers that previously were just being diagnosed in 60, 70-year-olds. So something else is going on. And I think the most promising data is coming from ultra-processed foods, from microplastics in the water, from environmental exposures, you know, these forever chemicals. There's so many possible culprits leading to this rise, and I think that's why more research is necessary, and also more education on healthy living is essential these days.
Yes. So to spotlight what you just mentioned, microplastics, water, air pollution, do these cause cancer, or are we still looking at correlation?
Many of them have been shown to cause cancer in the lab, right, on a cellular level in animal models. They've been shown to cause cancer. When it comes to humans, that's always a much more challenging question to answer because obviously no one is doing experiments on human beings, thankfully. But we know that they are associated with an increased risk of cancer, right? For instance, the forever chemicals, the PFAS, all these other plastic byproducts, which are, what I saw a report recently, have been found in basically the water of every major city in the country to some degree. These chemicals have been shown to have an increased risk with renal cancer, bladder cancer, lung cancer. And so it's always very hard to tease out, especially in our modern day lifestyles when we're exposed to so many things, what specifically is causing the issue and how much every single factor contributes. But we can say without a doubt that on the whole, exposure to environmental, to water and air pollutants, without a doubt increases the risk of cancer. And in fact, air pollutants in many parts of the world are the second leading cause of lung cancer after smoking.
Author, researcher, medical doctor Adam Barsuk with us. Outsmarting Cancer, Risk Reduction and the Power of Prevention. Are there long COVID and cancer risks here?
That's also an excellent question that unfortunately we don't quite know the answer yet. We know that long COVID causes a long-term inflammatory response, right? So that overactive immune system that we see during the COVID infection, it keeps acting up even after the COVID is all gone for months, for years. And we also know that overactive immunity, inflammation, is kind of the root cause of most cases of cancer. So in the laboratory, we are seeing that this inflammatory milieu, this storm of overactive immunity can cause cells to become cancerous. Whether we're going to see that play out in human beings, I think it's going to take several years until we can truly know. But what we do know is that many people, due to the COVID pandemic shutdowns, missed their cancer screenings, right? They weren't able to get their mammograms, their colonoscopies, other forms like lung cancer screening for smokers. And we know that because those people have missed those screenings and many of them haven't come back to get them at all, there's going to be tens of thousands of additional cancer deaths in this country alone because we're not finding the cancers as early as we should because of the repercussions of the shutdown. So the most important thing that anyone can do is if they've been out of touch with their doctor, you know, for whatever reason, it's so important to get re-engaged to see which screenings you're eligible for and make sure to get those scheduled because those truly do save lives.
Lastly, Dr. Barsuk, is it too late to make changes?
It's never too late. I think the truth is that there's no one magic bullet to curing or preventing cancer. It is a cumulative day-to-day risk. So every small change you make, if you stick with it over the months, over the years, it adds up to make a huge difference on your risk. So even if you're someone who smokes cigarettes, if you can smoke fewer a day, if you can drink less alcohol a day, if you can cut down on your consumption of ultra-processed foods, even skipping a snack a day, you know, it all adds up in the long term. And the most effective diet, the most effective lifestyle is the one that you're able to stick with and continue day in and day out. So I think it's never too late, and it's so valuable that we're getting this data right now about all the different risk factors. And that's why I felt it was so important to share in my now-published book, Outsmarting Cancer.
That is why we are simply your messenger. Outsmarting Cancer, Risk Reduction, and the Power of Prevention. Dr. Adam Barsuk, how do we find out more information?
Yeah, please just Google Outsmarting Cancer. It's available on the Hopkins, Johns Hopkins University Press. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the local bookstore near you, or my website, Adam Barsuk, AdamBarsuk.com, has all of my writings.
Thank you for your thoroughness and what you are doing for another. Take care to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
He's back, not only on our airwaves, but in your bookstore, The Devil's Bible. Steve Berry with us, New York Times bestselling author, out with another, you bet, a Cotton Malone novel. What's it mean and why should you care? Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning.
Appreciate you. Do you write every day?
I write every day. I was doing that this morning.
Wonderful. The Devil's Bible. Steve Berry, I know you've got a lot going on with the good work that you do. 20 Cotton Malone novels, 6 standalone thrillers, and certainly more. Founder of History Matters. We've talked about that. Let's get into, again, your premise when it comes to Cotton Malone.
This book is interesting. It deals with the largest book in the world. It's 3 foot tall, 2 foot wide, 9 inches thick, 165 pounds. Created in the early part of the 13th century somewhere in Bohemia, which is the Czech Republic today. We don't know where or who created it. We just know it was in that area. The Swedes stole it in 1648 when they stormed Prague Castle, and it's been in Stockholm ever since. And now Cotton Malone gets involved with it, and Russia, Sweden, the Czech Republic, and the United States all want the Devil's Bible, but for totally different reasons, and Cotton's got to steal it and get it to the right one.
And we won't certainly give away the ending. Why the title, The Devil's Bible?
That's what the book acquired its name. It was originally called the Codex Gigas, which is giant book. But when it got to Sweden, because of the really odd, unique drawing of the devil that appears in the middle of the book, it acquired this name, The Devil's Bible. It's a very odd depiction of the devil pre-Renaissance. I invite listeners to Google that, Devil's Bible, picture of the devil. Take a look at it and see. You'll see what I mean. Very, very odd drawing, and it acquired that nickname over the 400 years it's been in Sweden.
How'd you research this particular episode of Cotton's Adventure?
I went to Stockholm. Mm-hmm. I spent 8 days there, learned an awful lot. The curator of the Devil's Bible sat down with me, taught me a lot about the book. I've got to see the locales of the novel, and then I did my usual 300 to 400 sources that I use for each book and came back home and wrote it.
And how did Cotton Malone get invented in the first place?
I was sitting in a cafe in Copenhagen on a nice, lovely spring evening, and he popped into my brain. I said he's going to be a retired Justice Department agent. He's going to live here. He's going to own an old bookshop. He's going to get himself into trouble. And I wrote The Templar Legacy, which came out 20 years ago in 2006. And now here we are 20 Cotton Malones later.
Are his adventures all international?
No, they're not. I have about 6 American adventures that are focused on some very interesting things from the Constitution, thrillers that involve that. And then the rest are international with a little bit of an American overtone to it. I like the international a little bit better, but the Americans was fascinating because I wanted to explore those little flaws in the Constitution.
Oh, good. Steve Barry, again, The Devil's Bible, his latest. Tell me, obviously you practice what you preach, but should an author writing international stories be in that international space?
They don't have to go there. You don't have to go to locales. It helps. And the reason why is because you learn so much there that you can't find in books. It just doesn't exist, and this is a good example. I learned things about the Devil's Bible I never would have found. There's very little written about this, so it's hard to research it, and the curator gave me a book on it, which was lovely, which really, really helped me a lot. So you don't have to go, but it certainly does help.
There's the fine line. Let me ask you once again about how History Matters is going.
We're doing our projects, raising money. We've done a little under about 90-something projects, about $3 million raised. We help out communities in historic preservation, so we've done all kinds of things, books, posters, rooftops, buildings, cemeteries, you name it. We've raised money for it in local communities, and it's been very gratifying. And anybody has a project out there, they can go to my website, steveberry.org, click on History Matters, send us an email, and we'll see if we can come help you.
And then give me the angle of your work with the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board.
On that board for 6 years, which is an advisory board that deals with the libraries. It's basically a fundraising arm, but we had extraordinary access into the Smithsonian, which was incredible. And I wrote the book The Lost Order, which is a Smithsonian-based book, from that experience that I had there with that was another Cotton Malone adventure I had that I got from being on the board. It was really cool to go behind the scenes and see all the cool stuff and how the Smithsonian works.
And lastly, I do this every time, but remind me of how the good work of the International Thriller Writers.
It's a group of about 5,000 thriller writers from around the world. It's sort of like the Guild of Thriller Writers. So, if you write thrillers and you haven't joined, it's easy to join and it's free.
Hey, they say nothing's free, but this is The Devil's Bible. Steve Barry, how do we find out more information about your work?
Everything's at the website, steveberry.org. All 29 books are there. You can check them out and see which one you like. By the way, you don't have to read the Cotton Malone books in order. You can pick them up anywhere you want in any order. I write them that way on purpose.
Go backwards, as they say. Keep up your good work, Steve. I know we'll talk again. Take care.
Thank you.
In the morning, so much theater in our own backyard, so we turn to one that's pretty close, Master Arts Theater, if you haven't been to their wonderful setting, just do, and you can do it as early as February 27th. That's Friday night, and Colleen Thompson, you and yours on stage for the opening of The Women of Lockerbie. Colleen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Shelley.
Appreciate you. Give me the 101 of Master Arts Theater, please.
Master Arts Theater has been around for 40-some years, and it was started and still is a theater company that focuses on doing plays about ethical stories, plays about faith that has a Christian worldview. I have participated since 2013, and for a little theater, it's a real well-hidden gem in Grand Rapids.
Where are you located?
It's located on 77th Street off of Division in a building that's a former church. And I believe it's Cutlerville, between Cutlerville and Byron Center.
And how wonderful you have a whole building dedicated to your theater.
Yes, yes.
I remember way back when that happened, and look how much has graced the stage. And the women of Lockerbie grace the stage this coming Friday. Is this what we call the opening of your season?
No, actually, the opening of the season is every September.
Ah.
So this play is like the fourth play we've done this season.
Followed by Arsenic and Old Lace. I was in that way back when in another stage. Might have to look at that. Things We Couldn't Say in May. But the Women of Lockerbie, how are you involved, Colleen?
I am the director of the play. I have the privilege of directing it. And the story is a true story. In December 21st, in 1988, Pan Am 103 exploded by a terrorist bomb over the village of Lockerbie, Scotland. And the play takes place 7 years after, and how the survivors are dealing with the trauma that they experienced.
Why the choice of this particular production for Master Arts?
I think when the play reading committee read the show, Shelley, it's a beautifully written play. It's very poetic, the dialogue. It's about grief. It's about resilience. It's about community and how tragedy can bring the best out in people. There's redemption in it. It's just really, I'm surprised the play's not done more often. It's really, really good material for actors.
Remind me who are some of your actors, and in general, how this will be portrayed on stage?
Well, we've got 8 actors in the cast that are all local community theater actors. And I have to say, I'm prejudiced because I'm directing it, but I've been around for a while, and I think it's some of the finest acting I've seen on a community theater stage or anywhere. We're doing it alley style, which is audience on each side. So the audience will be drawn in to the experience of the play. Minimal set. Everything really is the script and the actors. And it's just been an incredible experience. And it's a difficult subject matter, but I think audiences sometimes need to check in with their own humanity and put their own lives in perspective when they see what other people have gone through.
Colleen, this is described as a poetic drama. How is this in the theater world? What's the layman term for this?
Well, one thing the playwright did was she utilizes a Greek chorus. And I guess back in the Greek chorus days, when they told difficult stories of battles and things like that, they had a chorus do it for dance or song. This one is done through poetry. The way the lines are written is like poetry. So the women who are doing the Greek chorus, they do different blocking configurations. it's like they step out of the story, and part of the reasoning for that is to protect the audience from difficult material. I've never worked with this type of play before where you have a Greek chorus, but I think it really works. It goes in and out of conversational dialogue into this poetry, and it is really, really beautiful.
And The Women of Lockerbie, yes, opening this Friday, Master Arts Theater. Director Colleen Thompson with us. Tell me, is there a need for accent work here?
Yes, we have five characters who all have Scottish accents. We brought in a fellow actor who schooled the women, if you will, in how to do the accents. I think I'm terrible at accents. I think a Scottish accent is one of the hardest to do. And he was able to work with them. And I have to say, I think they've really grown into the accents. And yet they're understandable. Sometimes it's hard to latch on to that Scottish accent, but they've done a really fine job of doing it. And then we have three American characters.
Appreciate that as well. What's your directing style, Colleen?
Oh boy, I like to lift people up. So I guess I'm a very gentle director, and I try to visualize the plays that I've directed, which has only been four, but I've acted a lot. I think that I just really want the actors to feel safe. Especially when you have to be so vulnerable like you do in The Women of Lockerbie. So I like to lift them up. Any kind of negative notes, I do those privately because nobody else needs to know. I mean, you're trying to help an actor grow in their role. And that is that's the greatest privilege that a director can have, if someone takes your counsel and they're able to grow in their character. So I guess I would say a very visual, very gentle kind of director.
Good to know. There we are. All right. How does one get a ticket or two for The Women of Lockerbie, Colleen?
Well, you can either call Master Arts Theater by going to their website, or go directly to their website, and you can purchase tickets online. And we run from February 27th till March 14th, and that will be four shows a weekend, except for this weekend.
Get your energy, get your actors into character, and then you sit back and relax. Can you do that, Colleen?
I can. I told them Friday night, I hand the baby over to them to be delivered, and I'm so proud of them.
There's a visual, but it is your baby. Lots of labor into that, I jest. All right, Colleen Thompson, good work directing The Women of Lockerbie at Master Arts Theater that does open this Friday night. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks, Shelley.
Hope you enjoyed the show, your inspiration for the day. According to George R.R. Martin, winter is coming and is here. There we are. Gloves required today. This too shall change. Take care.